That needs to start with every woman voting and understanding the power of their vote. We are 51% of the electorate. We are the dominant, not numerically, part of the electorate. And yet, time and time again, I think we feel that our interests are not taken into account.
Wowee. I just met Helen Pankhurst CBE, a woman whose life is a testament to the enduring spirit of the suffragettes. I mean, what didn't we cover in this episode? Her stories, her heritage, this unique glimpse of the struggles and the pioneering spirit of her ancestors, you know, driving the change that she has wanted to see in her lifetime when it came to women and comes to women, and passionately speaking about Centenary Action. It's a movement that she wants for all of us women to join. 100 years it would have been since women got the vote in 2028, and she is calling us to arms. She would love us to make the changes that we need to see in this country. This is a woman that needs to be listened to, calm, collected, considered, intelligent, balanced. All of these things came into our conversation. It was one of those hours in your life that you are going to learn so much, and I hope at the end of it, feel a passionate need to be part of feminism and to be part of a sisterhood. Because you listening, me, Helen, we're sisters. And that's a beautiful thing. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Hello, Helen. It is a great pleasure to meet you. A real honour for you joining us on Conversations of Inspiration today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you, Holly.
Well, you know, I obviously know exactly who you are because I've had so much fun researching you, but everyone sort of knows who you are because you are a women's rights activist, you're a scholar and a writer, and it shouldn't come as any surprise to anybody to understand your heritage because what you do runs in your blood and you have a very famous surname, a pretty illustrious legacy. So again, we cannot wait to hear more about your viewpoints, because this is a podcast, certainly myself, Holly, I'm different to you, of course, but I have dedicated my life really to women in different ways. And the questions I'm going to ask you today, I'm so interested to know what you think, because it can be it can feel like a lonely old road sometimes. Do you ever feel that?
Possibly. I do feel that I'm very much surrounded by that history and they are with me somehow. So I don't feel that lonely because of that sense of connection to the past, I think. But maybe I do in the sense of frustration with how slow change has been and continues to be somehow.
Because you're the great-granddaughter of Emmeline Pankhurst, the woman who founded the great British suffragette movement, and the granddaughter of Sylvia Pankhurst. So these giant boots that you fill, tell me about the general election looming on the 4th of July, because I wanted to dive straight into this. Your ancestors would be, you know, sitting by your side right now when a subject like this is coming up. And I want to hear more about your Centenary Action, a mission you've established, which is about supporting and mobilising women to get out there and vote, to have our says on policy, to shape our lives. Might you tell us more about this and also the call out out to business leaders and entrepreneurs to make the promise to enable employees to vote?
Let me start with the kind of the ultimate goal, which is that by 2028, which will be the centenary of when all women got the vote, and it's only 4 years from now, that we get to equal representation in Parliament. So the same number of women as men in Parliament. We are currently at 35% and we need to get to 50%. So that's the ultimate goal. And I can come back to that down the line. But we're at one moment right now, 2024, when we have these elections, and therefore the power is in the citizens' hands to use that power for change. And that needs to start with every woman voting and understanding the power of their vote. We are 51% of the electorate. We are the dominant, numerically, part of the electorate. And yet, time and time again, I think we feel that our interests are not taken into account. So, for example, when you see a lot of research, it tends to aggregate and not tell us what women and men think about things. And yet we know that, for example, there are more women who are swing voters. So when the analysis is done, we find that out. We also know that when it comes to policies, everything affects men and women differently. So take the cost of living crisis, which keeps on being talked about by all the parties. They very rarely talk about the fact that women are often at the brunt end of that. There is a feminization of poverty. So women are more likely to be affected by that. Take social care, take all sorts of aspects, you know, social care, it's often women that are affected by and doing it, so looking after the young, the elderly, the disabled, or in paid employment as often marginalised women who are doing the work of that caring. So why can't we have politicians, when they are talking about taxation or talking about services, explain and look at it from the gendered angle? I don't think they are. And I think as voters, we need to demand that of them. And then coming back to, so I think we need to use our power. We need to call the candidates to account. So when they come knocking on our doors, we should be saying to them, what is your policy on the gender pay gap? What is your policy to address the fact that domestic violence is still so rampant? What is your policy to address the fact that so many women in their biology, in their health, have gynecological issues which are not prioritised by the NHS, etc.? So I would like to see us as citizens, us as women, using that power to call politicians to account. And then ultimately, I would like to see as many women represented in Parliament as there are men. It's long overdue.
Yes, yes, yes. Because, I mean, this is my listeners always know I say this. It's, you have guests like yourself come on and you just want to say, well, this makes perfect sense. Absolutely perfect sense. If I speak to Tim Smith about the environment, if you speak to Riverford about the farms and how the soil could actually save our environmental situation. Time and time again, it is very, very clear some of the things that need to happen. And yet the powers are with people who are not making these progress. Because when you mentioned those crazy stats, you know, women make up 51% of the population and yet account for 35% of MPs. And I was shocked to know that there has only ever been 564 women MPs who, when you put them together, wouldn't even fill the House of Commons. And you've said, if women aren't in that space, their interests are not taken into account in that way. And that's what this is all about. And we're falling behind nations such as Australia, New Zealand, France, Spain, and the Netherlands.
We are 46th in the world in terms of gender representation. 46th, the mother of parliaments. We are 46th in the world. So, you know, I'm sorry, but that just isn't good enough.
Why aren't women being represented as they should? And is it because, and I'm wondering if you're going to say potentially yes, of the outdated structures that the mother of parliament has?
Yeah, it's got a lot to do with the way parliament operates. It's got a lot to do with the culture. So it's about norms as well, and the culture as well as policies and structures. The different parties have different problems. So the Labour Party will probably argue that they have difficulties around the structures whereas the Conservative Party say that they have difficulties around women putting themselves forward. So the Labour Party historically used an all-female shortlist method last time of the elections to get more women in there. It hasn't been able to do that for this election because they got to 51% last time, so they can't use the same strategy. So each of the parties would say that there are slightly different, and it's true, they have slightly different hurdles. But fundamentally, the way Parliament operates, and it's very poor HR systems and the culture and the world that we live in which any woman who makes herself visible is liable to all sorts of social media abuse. Politicians get it particularly badly, but any woman who puts her head above the parapet tends to get it. So lots and lots of reasons. Economic inequalities are part of the story. The fact that women MPs don't have wives by and large, whereas male MPs have wives that support them by and large. So lots of reasons. And yet, without that changing, we won't get anywhere. One other stat I wanted to give you, which is not widely known, is from our figures, 214 constituencies have never had a woman. So in the UK, there are 214 constituencies which literally have never been represented by a woman MP.
I'm going to not conclude after every single thing you say. I think that when you talk about women having wives, just generally, I would even say, is an issue that we see within business. We're talking about just that support. That's what I use the word wives. It's that support that you have of the care, of the home, of life outside one's business or job as an MP. I read a piece just the other day saying that women candidates are overlooked and kept away from the shortlists. You mentioned this. What are some of the hurdles that women are facing when they are seeking political selection or election?
Yeah, they are very similar. So it's back to cultures, norms, structures. It's actually back to who is making the selection, the selectorate. By the way, the figures we think are about 30% of the candidates are women this time round. 30%, might be 31%. It's very low. Now, after the election, the figures are likely to have gone up. So we're likely to have gone up from the 35% that we are at the moment. Estimates are we might get as much as 40% by the next election because Labour will do better. And Labour, by and large, has been better at getting, as a percentage, more of its candidates. There, as I said, you know, we are very much a cross-party, non-party political initiative, the Centenary Action. And in my bones, I am a cross-party person. I see the strengths and weaknesses of different parties. I think it's the collaboration across parties that's its strongest. But you also have to unpick and see that, for example, Labour Party has been better at getting more women candidates and the Conservative Party has been better at getting more women at the very top. We have had three female prime ministers from the Conservative Party, none from the Labour Party. So, you know, all of them have weaknesses. And if they all address their weaknesses, we'd be at a better place. By the way, one of our campaigns is to get the Section 106 of the Equality Act, which, if enacted, would force the parties to be much more transparent about their candidates. And we think that transparency is the best solution to all forms of discrimination and inequality. That will probably happen. It's being pushed and it will probably happen.
Fantastic. Gosh, well, a micro step in the right direction. And just to also list some of the areas that when we think about women and, you know, just again, someone's like, what are you actually talking about, Holly? Well, you know, costs are high and personal circumstances may prohibit women to being involved in selection or election. Politics can be full time. Many women don't have the time or the flexibility required because by very nature, we are women. So we were already put in that situation before maybe we decided we wanted to get into the world of politics, caring responsibilities. We're this sandwich generation where you've got the most young and old to look after. And actually, that is a huge invisible labour. Personal networks, if you're not out there, how do you know the people to get there? Selection bias. Women face questions about childcare and marital status and abuse and harassment. You know, women of colour especially disproportionately targeted. And I was just talking, Helen, to a friend of mine, and she was so strong in this text. And I said, have you ever thought about running? I think she'd make an amazing representation of women in politics, whatever party, but just she needs to be somewhere. And she said, yes, but she looks after security. And she said, we're working with some female MPs. She said, I don't know if I could ever go through what they go through. I said, what do you mean? And she said, it's absolutely disgusting, specifically women in politics and what they endure. Why is that? Is this because it's a male-dominated zone? I don't know how to articulate it. So almost women are infiltrating into somewhere that they don't belong?
It's the epitome of the establishment, and it doesn't want to adapt, you know, in so many ways. By the way, a lot of women MPs, almost all of them that I have spoken to, will say that issue of the abuse is horrific. It is intersectional, so black women get so much more of it than other women. But they will all say, and yet it is the best job in the world. So they will all say, don't not think of becoming an MP because it is just an amazing job. And if you want to lead, if you want to get to the top as a woman in any sphere, you're likely to get a lot of that abuse. It's part of the way that the world operates. And we need to be in power to be able to change that, to push for change, for it to be normal, normalized that women are at the very top and in the same numbers as men.
What would you say? Because I'll be honest with you, I'm coming up to my 200th episode of this podcast. So that is wonderful people I've spoken to. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, I come away just wanting the sanity that I've just heard to actually be represented. So that for the majority, I wish the UK was listening to this podcast, you know, and to actually hear this. But I would say that, and certainly even myself, okay, let's go here. Even myself, over time, people have said to me, Holly, you should get into politics. I feel like you would do well or whatever. And I say, are you joking me? I say, I can't think of a worse job for the way it's run, for the bureaucracy, for the lack of speed, the boys club, to listening to you and not being able to put you in charge of, like, you know, as an entrepreneur, as a business person, you go, okay, this person has got real life experience. Let's not do the boys club and things like that. So I shy away. I say, are you joking me? And actually every guest, I'd say, Helen, every guest I've spoken to who has that wisdom like yourself in different areas, they shy away from politics. What would you say to women to say, but you've got to do it?
So I would say that women are stepping up. We are not at 31% of the candidates because women are not stepping up. We know that a lot of women are not being selected because of all of the reasons why, you know, we talked before. So let's support those women who are willing to put themselves forward. And it might be certain categories of women. It might be at certain ages, for example. But whoever they are, let's encourage them in their diversity if they are willing to step forward, and let's push for a better way of working. And, you know, you talked about being an entrepreneur, and this kind of makes me think about one of the initiatives that we're involved in, which is that we feel that the link between women in business and women in parliament needs to be strengthened. You know, that link with men often exists. Men in business and in politics and in the media sometimes know each other because they went to the same schools, colleges, clubs, etc. There is that network which doesn't exist for women. And I'm not trying to replicate a exclusive girls club. But what I am saying is within the power hierarchies that exist, women need to understand those differences and different worlds, and they need to support each other across that. And the best of business is amazing in terms of having flexible ways of working and understanding the link between human beings as humans and as workers and as family and all the rest of it. And if we could influence Parliament to get the best of business and change Parliament so that it is much better in terms of its own HR systems because of that, addressing issues of abuse, etc., having better systems within Parliament. And if the business world could help us do that, that would be an amazing thing to do. So one of our calls around this election period with a centenary action is this promise. And the promise is a request for businesses to engage in supporting their staff to register to vote, to understand all of the dates of when they proxy deadlines,
yes,
and polling deadlines, all of that, the dates, encouraging them to be educated as citizens, and that's a role that businesses can play, and then support staff to also be engaged in democracy and not see democracy and business as something that's totally separate. And I think there would be so much power and positivity about bringing those two together with a feminist lens.
Since I was a child, I've always been curious about art, passionate about trying new things, and fascinated by finding new ways to express myself. And since setting up my first business, Not in the High Street, my vision has always been to create a world in which someone just like you or I can be creatively inspired. So whether that's been through a podcast like this one, or by helping you turn your dreams into a business, or to enjoy shopping for thoughtful, never-before-seen finds that take you in a new direction or help show the world how you feel. When I discovered the small business community, I have to say it felt like I was coming home. And there are people who can translate emotions into objects, people who can conceive of things we never could have and have talent beyond our wildest imaginations. That's why I set up Holly & Co, to bring them all together, to support each other and to help you showcase your creativity and style, whether that be through gifts for others or through styling your own home. To be inspired and to find out more about all of this world I've created, visit holly.co. Now, back to our conversation of inspiration. I'm going to go back to your childhood because I'd love to learn more about it. Tell me what it was like growing up with such an iconic surname. I'm presuming kids didn't really understand or know about it. You know, you'd have to be a certain age, wouldn't you, to really get it.
Yeah. So there were these two backgrounds. I grew up in Ethiopia and that was the main influence on me. But then I used to come, even very young, to the UK during the summer holidays. And there, whenever an adult came across my surname, they would be the ones to ask. So it would be an adult seeing the surname and saying, are you related? And then I didn't initially really understand what that was all about. And then gradually I did. And then the more I understood the power and complexity of that story, because they were a really interested family that did very, had different views.
Your grandmother, Sylvia, settled there in 1950s. And as a result, you spent, as you said, that early childhood until you were around 12 living there with your mother, Rita, and your father, Richard, and your brother, Alula. Is that
right?
Was he born in Ethiopia? Is that...
No, he was born in London, actually. But we both had Ethiopian names and European names. And his Ethiopian name stuck, which was Alula. And my middle name is Tariq, which means history. And that's because my father was writing a general history of Ethiopia, hence Tariq, as my name. And he was writing something about a general, Ras Alula. And so Alula became Alula rather than Stephen Andrew, which were his other names.
Okay, well, we need to get into this then. So history is in your blood. So your dad's writing just that little, after breakfast, just going to write the history of Ethiopia. tell me about what your childhood was like. Was did your mother and your father do?
So they were very interested in Ethiopian culture, history. My father was interested in one thing or another, which often influenced what we did. So I remember a period when he was looking at the caves of Ethiopia. So we were trekking up and down the country looking at caves, or there was a time when he was doing research on the different games that exist in Ethiopia. So we were looking at the games that Ethiopians played. That was part of my background. And then I went to a French school. So I spoke French at school rather than English. So that background also meant an international interest, I think. But yeah, it was very much who I was this Ethiopian identity. I spoke Amharic, still speak Amharic fluently. And it marked me in terms of choosing what I then ended up doing. So became interested in international development work and have worked in that sphere with charities and humanitarian organisations ever since.
It's incredible because, again, this environment that us as children soak up, you know, just is it's so prevalent in people's lives. And it just does take a moment to actually acknowledge that and actually see that. Because I'm wondering, when you think about Ethiopia and the society, there, women bear the brunt of physical labour, I would say, the care around women. Do you think you saw that as a young child? Do you think that, again, forget your heritage in a way, you just were in Ethiopia, you were seeing something that happened to also link with your ancestry?
Yeah, absolutely. And the more I worked on it as well, the more I understood that you couldn't look at international development issues or humanitarian issues without a gendered lens. Likewise for climate, which is now so much part of humanitarian and development work. But my experiences of seeing women carrying jerrycans of water on their back, I ended up doing a lot. I do a lot with water and sanitation issues. Seeing women carrying sticks for fuel on their back bent over was an image I had from very young. And yet women were seen to be not strong. And I remember thinking, hang on a minute, how can you say women are not strong when they're back, you know, carrying all of this weight? And then, you know, I think having to think about different cultures and actually the commonality of experiences. So in some ways, it might be easy to assume that things are that much worse for women in Ethiopia than they are in the UK. But the commonalities are there in some ways greater than the differences. So, you know, domestic violence of one form or another, it's here, it's there. Economic equalities. Some ways the marriage rights in Ethiopia were stronger than the marriage rights here. So seeing the comparison, I think when you are brought up with different cultures, that also makes you reflect on both, really.
Yes, the comparisons of it. I'm wondering, when you were growing up, you didn't actually ever meet your grandmother, Sylvia. I think she sadly died 4 years before you were born, and growing up in Ethiopia, but you slept in her room. That was your room. She was present in some way. Did you feel that? Did you know that?
No, it was, her influence was very much there. In fact, much more so than Emmeline and the suffragette influence. When I was very young, it was Sylvia's presence, her influence in Ethiopia, her fight for Ethiopia's independence against Mussolini, her interest in the culture. The other middle name I have, by the way, is Sylvia. So I'm Helen Sylvia Tarek Pankhurst. So now you've got the whole story. And yeah, she was very much there, I think, with my parents, who would mention her a fair amount, and other people would as well.
And I also read that you said work was always very important in the family. As you come into the house, the first thing you see is a desk, and that was where Sylvia used to work. When she died, this is where she was found, at her desk. I mean, that's very moving. The work, maybe your work, maybe when women find their place in the world, combining their passion and their beliefs and their values and work, it's quite a magical place. Do you ever believe that yourself when you sort of wake up in the morning?
That's a beautiful way of putting it, actually, Holly. I think that you've conjured up the imagery of that focus on the desk. And as you're speaking it, obviously, in my mind's eye, I can see that desk. The other thing is, she was given once towards the end of her life, I think, a paperweight. It's a small, round, white paperweight that was made by some students. And it has superimposed on it the following letters, O-T-H-E-R-S, others. And she was given that because of a sense that that's, she always focused on others. That was her interest, try and make things better for others. And it was for me, a really powerful summary of her life, her interests, the fact that she took on one cause after another. So she's known in the UK because of her suffragette initiatives, but also because she focused on working class women. She worked in the East End of London and was very interested in the intersection between class and gender. But she took up many other issues as well, was an anti-racist, was a pacifist in the First World War, but then realised the importance of addressing fascism. So a complex person who took on one issue after another.
Believing in the power of her force in the 29,000 days that she had on the planet, whatever, you know, that she could make a difference. And to anyone listening here, you know, firstly, I forgot to say, everybody, you know, anyone listening here, vote. This is the, I had actually written that down to say, but please, everyone vote, that if you've heard Helen now, there is absolute need, all of us on the 4th of July to say what we feel, to back our sisters, to try and make change.
So people might be disillusioned, negative, feel that there's a toxicity out there. What's the point? Apathy, all the rest of it. And I can understand why people might feel that. But as citizens, this is the one moment, the brief moments that we have power. We have power that many others don't have, that many didn't have, that many fought for, gave up their life for, suffered all sorts of indignities for. So let's engage with the issues that matter with us, you know, climate, poverty, whatever it is, and let's do a lot more. But just to sit back and say, oh, well, you know, they're a bunch of liars.
They've lost
or
me.
Oh, well,
yeah, exactly.
Is just not an effective solution to the problem. The effective solution is vote, use that little bit of power, be part of that jigsaw puzzle, honour that, and then get involved in other ways.
Everyone listening is going to do that, I can just tell. So let's get back to your story. You came back to the UK when you were 12, fleeing Ethiopia because of the revolution that was brewing. And although you visited England before on summer breaks, you are now here more permanently. Was that a culture shock?
We thought we knew the UK because we had visited, but when you actually live in a country, it's very different. Actually, a few memories as well of that transition period. So one was that my mother had talked to us very seriously, my brother and I, to say on the flight on the way here, you know, we were now going to be living in the UK and things did, people behaved slightly differently in the UK. And for example, you had to be much more obedient to the rules and, you know, do things the right way. And this was in 1976 when there was a drought in the UK. And we stayed at my grandfather's. And at the time, we heard that there was this water ban, so you're not supposed to be gardening. The following morning, we wake up to see my grandfather watering the lawn. So we rush out to my mother and say, but, you know, you said that you obey the rules in the UK. Granddad, you know, Overpa is watering the lawn. So we realised it was all a little bit more nuanced than that. But yeah, lots of adapting to 1970s Britain, put it that way.
Yeah, it couldn't be more different, I can imagine. When you got back to the UK and as a young woman, how did you then go into determining the impact of your own path and the decisions that you took regarding your education?
Yeah, and education is really, really important to me. I think academia is almost in the blood as well. So having studied at the French school in Ethiopia, and my mother chose that because she felt that that would give us an extra language. It was also slightly closer than the English school and was more international and had yes. more Ethiopian students. So there are lots of reasons for choosing that. We then continued a little bit with the French school in London when we came to London. And then I went to the United World College in Wales, which is a scholarship school. It's the International Baccalaureate. So the transition to that was really interesting and really good. I really like that educational system. And then I went to Sussex University, which was very radical and kind of suited me at the time. It was also really good at the international development work. There was the IDS, Institute of Development Studies, and it continues. I went to Vassar in the States for a year. I then went to Scotland, so Scottish background as well, with a PhD in Edinburgh. And then I have continued a bit of an academic hat to the present. So really important to the way I think and value what we do, I think.
I read that your parents said, and now and again, my parents had talked about the suffragettes, but they had very busy lives. And I think they felt wisely that in my own time, I'd become interested. And then the more I looked into it, the more interesting it was. And the stereotypical picture of the suffragettes is of middle-class ladies, but they ranged right across society. And that actually your name started to means something there. When did you think that that sort of feminism landscape for yourself evolved?
I think it was gradual. So having seen a bit of that in Ethiopia with those images I talked about with the woman bent over with carrying water, having through my education also started to explore some gender issues through the economic, I was studying economics, there was a gradual sense, I think, that this issue hadn't gone away. It wasn't like women got the vote, thanks partly to, you know, Sylvia and Emmeline and the suffragettes, many others. It was done and dusted. There was a sense, a growing sense, that it was still a live issue through work, through personal experiences, through seeing things like the way girls were treated rather than boys, the giving up of sports, which was happening a lot, boys continuing in sports, girls not, the concern around safety for girls and not for boys. So my own life, it started to be relevant. The issue about whether I changed my surname or not in marriage, the issue about whether my kids would have my surname or not. It's integral, I think, to any woman's experience, that sense of what society says about women. And therefore, is there a voice that I had in terms of saying, hang on a minute, does it need to be this way? And don't we still need to do something to address the barriers that remain?
The evolution that we've seen since the suffragettes, so this is what we're sort of talking about now, coming into, you're now here, you're prevalent, this is what you're going to do. I'd love to know more about your view on some of the movements that we see today, such as Me Too, and whether you think that these might have been a campaign focus for the suffragettes if they were around in that form.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen, so since the suffragettes, we've seen a whole series of movements and cycles that have addressed different issues. So there was a lot around the gender pay gap for a while. Not even, it was called equal pay, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah,
initially. And then there was a lot around body positivity and sexual freedom. I think you can picture waves of issues that come and go that are not the only one, but they're ones that galvanize women and that get caught up by political voice or and media attention. And again, depending on what country you are, which continent you're at, those might be different issues that are surfacing. And then Me Too happened, which galvanized so many sectors of society at different points. It started with the cinema and with women in that sector, I think, primarily. Mm-hmm. But then trickled into all forms of work globally. So that was linked, and many women did reference the kind of the waves of feminism, the Me Too as a wave that drew a lot of attention and was something that needed social change so that it wasn't just acceptable that women should be violated, abused, that required policy and structural changes, laws that ensured that these were changes and agency changes so that individuals knew that they could speak up, needed to speak up and shouldn't be treated by abuse by men, primarily women at the receiving end of male violence, female receipt of male violence. So we don't tend to call that explicitly in that way. We just talk about violence against women. We never name it as male violence against women, which is what it predominantly is, not exclusively, but predominantly.
And you talk about, you know, these movements are worldwide, and this is, it's to all women on our planet who experience this. Like you were saying about Ethiopia, to our culture, there is the commonalities of these things are global. And your work with Womankind Worldwide and CARE International must give you that lens, that truly global lens. And in recent years, you've probably, and people definitely listening, have been watching The Handmaid's Tale. On one hand, you have this terrible dystopian story, and on the other hand, frightening real, and especially when you see things such as the overturning of Roe versus Wade. What's your point of view on that, of ending women's rights to have abortion in some states of America? And do you think it symbolises that we've actually taken a step backwards since the advancements of your ancestors? Is this whole thing right now, we're going to come, you can see what I'm doing, trying to get to the sort of bit of like, give us hope, Helen, but I'm going to ask you that bit in a minute. Is it, we go two steps forward, one step backwards? Is that going to be how it is? And what is your view on that?
I wrote a book called Deeds Not Words, The Story of Women's Rights Then and Now, looking at how far we'd got since women got the vote. And I looked at different areas. So chapter one is on politics, and I kind of assess how far we've got, and I ask people to rank it, and I do. And chapter two is on economics, and chapter three is on violence. Well, chapter three is on social issues. Chapter four is on violence. And every time I have talked to people about where we have progressed and where we haven't progressed, the issue of violence comes up as the area where we have progressed the least. Mm-hmm. And where there's a sense that things might not be going forward. So yeah, we might be getting a few more women in parliament, you know, 35%. Yes, gender pay gap might be improving. Yes, sports women more involved and the female lens in cinemas and so on. But in terms of safety, the fact that globally, women have a curfew around where and when they can be because of male violence against them, that is still a global phenomena. So from that point of view, violence is the factor that is pulling every other indicator of change down. And then you said forwards and backwards, and I think there is a bit of that. And in that book, and that's why I went to mention the book, somebody used the analogy of an elastic band. You know, that if you're trying to change things and you let go, assuming you've got there, what happens is it pings back, and actually it pings back even further back. And maybe that's what we're getting a bit. For the positivity of all of this, it does go back, but women will stand up, male allies will say, not good enough, and it might go back, but there will be enough people picking up that band and pushing for it to go back again. And I have hope that we mustn't be simplistic about it. It's not like it's done and dusted. We really have to care. We need to use our agency to push for change. And we will succeed, and we will persevere, and it needs that perseverance. You can't just assume that it's going to be better for your children and your children's children, and if you're not going to have children, for your friends' children and children's children.
And it's also, Helen, you know, on this podcast, I hope, you know, we hear that I advocate for responsibility, you know, and actually for all of us, I'll ask myself this today after talking to you. What do I, Holly, do to push the dial forward? Well, I have my business. Okay, fine. But someone listening, what do you do? Are you using your vote? What do you support? Who do you back? Who do you give encouragement? What is it that you do? And I think this is what you're alluding to as well. You know, life is very, very busy for women, right? It is absolutely. We are being squeezed. The invisible labor is real. The having it all notion in the 80s and where we've got to and all this sort of, and again, expectations and all those sort of things. We are busy human beings. And so finding that time for self, to finding time for self-care, all those sorts of things. But this is that thing, it's like we've got to find time for our values, that we actually have values as women. So what do we do in our daily life? And I'm going to talk to you about climate in a minute, but what do we do, however small, that what's that contribution that we're making? Because I feel, Helen, that we want to, by the way. I think women want it. Edwina Dunn,
absolutely.
The female pound goes round. It when you women notoriously, when they spend money, fine, if they want a Gucci handbag, whatever. But on other times, they will spend their money to help people. I'll buy that toilet roll because that is better for the environment. Or I'll support that charity. So that's one way we can do it, by voting with our money. Do you feel that we're asleep at the wheel slightly?
Yeah, so a few things on that. I mean, firstly, you mentioned women being time poor. I think that that's even more of an issue than economically poor. You know, we think about this feminization of poverty, that women tend to be the more the poorer in so many ways, they around the precarity of work, etc. And that is a reality. The statistics tell us that that's a reality. Even more so, and if they were weighted and counted equally to GDP in the way we measure things, women's lack of time because they are juggling so many other things is just such a big thing. So acknowledging that, I think, is really important. Small acts matter, really small acts matter. I think sometimes people think that change is only about big things and it's only about loud things. And even quiet activism is a term that's being used by Sarah Corbett, I think it is. And that kind of quiet activism, gentle activism is really important as well. Another imagery I'd like to leave people with is Adela. So Emmeline's youngest daughter went on to live in Australia, and she was talking to her granddaughter, Susan, who I talked to. So Susan said to me, she was once walking with her grandmother, and the grandmother said to her, pick up that piece of rubbish, that litter. And Susan said, well, what's the point of me picking up a piece of rubbish? You know, it's just one piece of rubbish. That's not going to make any difference. And Adela said to her, it will make a difference to how you view the problem. And I think that's really, really powerful, because it's saying to all of us, what we do changes our relationship to the world. And that's important. We might not be able to change the rest of the world, but we'll change our relationship to that problem, our relationship to the world.
Dell Technologies are passionate champions of small businesses. They recognise that it can be a lonely road, and so they have the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, or DWEN for short, which is a worldwide community of over 100,000 female founders. They run free events and mentoring programmes and have a network of brilliant women all connecting and sharing insight. They also recognise that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. So now I'm going to hand over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
Welcome to my sanctuary number 8, the home of sustainable luxury, and coming soon, my little sanctuary for all the little people in our lives. My Sanctuary Number 8 is the destination to discover a beautiful collection of unique furniture and homeware for the conscious consumer who loves their home to be as unique as they are. My Sanctuary Number 8 began life through a passion for creating, quite simply, beautiful things. Fused with an obsession for the art of transformation from old to new, My Sanctuary Number 8 proudly rescues furniture from a life in landfill, breathing new, vibrant life into pieces where there is still, sometimes hidden, beauty. From our statement occasional tables to antique writing bureaus and bedside tables, each piece is lovingly restored and finished professionally, ensuring that each item of furniture will last you a lifetime and bring unique character to your space not to be found anywhere else. You can find My Sanctuary at mysanctuarynumber8.com or across social media at My Sanctuary Number 8, spelt My Sanctuary N-O-8. Be sure to subscribe to our website or follow us to keep up to date. And remember to please keep a lookout for My Little Sanctuary, a magical world dedicated to our children furnishing their sanctuaries with completely non-toxic and safe but magical furniture. We look forward to welcoming you to our home online.
Thank you, Dell, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about DWEN and connect with brilliant and inspiring women, or you'd like to be in with a chance to have your very own ad break here on this series, head to holly.co/Dell. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration. Wow. I mean, I just love that that's in your family. That's just a little chat on the walk. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is everything profound in your family? You know, it's just like, gosh, I'm so lowbrow.
I'm just remembering the odd anecdote.
I know
the hours and hours of tea gym.
But I'm just saying, I can only imagine. I'd love to talk to you about another movement that's happening that we see in society today, climate change. And you previously said that climate change is a feminist issue, and that if you're suffragette ancestors are seen as heroes, and climate change protesters will be too, and that those that are against will find themselves on the wrong side of history. How do you marry our thoughts on doing all we can to protect the environment? And sometimes I would say the actions of groups such as Just Stop Oil, because I sometimes think I agree exactly with what you've just said, but I sometimes feel, is Just Stop Oil doing the worst PR job there could? I don't know. You know, that's for me.
Yeah.
I worry. I think what they are representing might be what we might all agree with, but I worry about the way that people are behaving.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting about Just Stop Oil is, in some ways, you could argue that they and Extinction Rebellion are like the suffragettes, and the suffragists are the Greenpeace, or even actually Greenpeace at the time when it first emerged was pretty radical, but more maybe the Green movement than the environmentalist movement, the quieter, less activist, less likely to be using confrontational methods. From that perspective, what's happening is there's a little bit of a rose-tinted spectacle when it comes to the suffragettes, despite the fact that they were so militant. And now everybody admires them, even people who then say, actually, Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil are problematic because they're disruptors. I think we need to look at all of it. And it's complicated. But I think that the different people need to decide what mechanism they are comfortable with, how they want to argue for change. And at different points in your life, and depending on your economic situation and your own sense of wanting to antagonize or not, and desperation versus small changes matter, depending on your own makeup.
Yes,
and
your barometer.
You might choose different methods. But I think it's important to understand that urgency that the most extremist organizations want to focus
put upon us.
Yeah.
Yes.
At the same time, like you, I personally am very uncomfortable with some of the more militant, disruptive tactics, because I am concerned, like you, that they might not help. I also think that those movements could learn a lot from some of the more lateral thinking type approaches and the humorous approaches that the suffragettes used. They didn't just use militant tactics, and they were forced into that militancy. They also did funny, quirky things, you know, like one of the first hot air balloons, Mural Matters, a suffragist combination, went into and wanted to distribute leaflets over the House of Commons. But this was very early on in the hot air balloon technology, and the balloon couldn't be directed to the right way. So she ended up in the wrong places and distributed the leaflets over whatever it was, cows and sheep and underneath where she landed. Point being that they used really interesting ways, and the media loved them because they were so colourful and quirky and used all of these alternative ways. And my suggestion to the extremists environmental movement is, I think you could learn a lot more from some of the other PR approaches and not necessarily these most disruptive ones.
Also very interesting, when we look at feminism and the environment, you said, as feminists and environmentalists, I support climate activists. The climate crisis is a feminist issue. It is disproportionately taking the lives and the futures of women and girls. Research by Care International found that 150 million more women than men experienced climate-induced hunger in 2021, while 900,000 children, most of them girls, are at risk of dropping out of school in somewhere, let's say, Somalia alone, due to the drought. And one step further, yet so few women at the decision-making tables, just 7 out of the 100, I mean, come on, yeah. 7 out of the 110 world leaders at COP27. Women are not responsible for this mandate climate mess, but they must be at the centre of finding solution. I mean, isn't it obvious? Isn't it obvious that we should be the nurturers, the carers? If one wants to band ourselves like that, should we not be there to care for the planet and help this?
Yeah, I mean, it is stark, isn't it? You explained all of it, you know, the element of women are more likely to face the environmental problem. That is more likely to affect them in a number of different ways because of our role as carers. We are more likely, say there is a drought, to be also looking after not just ourselves, but our youngsters and possibly the disabled person and the elderly person. We will be doing that. We will also be the one going to collect the water. We will be the one going to collect a few, you know, all sorts of roles that come with our socialized identities that mean that environmental crises tend to affect women in specific ways and put them at very marginalized position. Also, when all of that kicks in, violence increases because stress tends to lead to greater violence against women, etc., etc. All of these things are like layers of the onion where women often are disproportionately affected. And yet, when it comes to policies that are nuanced to understand that, women's voice is not heard. When it comes to the funding of policies, women are not receiving the funding to address their concerns. So it does seem absolutely ludicrous that this is the situation, and yet it is.
And you mentioned your book, Deeds Not Words, in 2019 that was published, and using all your knowledge and experience to explore, and I love these ideas, the chapters that you explored, looking at how, despite wave after wave of feminism, women are still not equal. So why is it taking so long? And what changes do we still need to see in our society? I mean, we've talked about some of those, but just tell me, I mean, it's 100 years since coming up to 100 years of the vote. You've been at it all your life. If we keep going at the same pace, it's going to be 249 years, I think, parity between men and women. Okay. Over to you. I don't know what she did. Sorry. Loaded question there. No. Big
okay.
one.
Okay. It's difficult because all of the ways society is structured rely on women being quiet, being supportive of men, not financially valued for the things that we do. The whole edifice of, if you want to be grand about this, capitalism and patriarchy rely on women's subordinate status. So the whole system kind of pushes down on women and girls. That's why it's hard. However, if and as we call that out, as we connect up across our differences as women, as we explain the problems of all of that for the world, when we've talked about, you know, climate, for the planet, the problems of that capitalist patriarchal system, its ideas of how to run economies and look after nature, you know, all of that needs a different eye. And I'm not saying that women would solve all of the problems. I'm saying that the way it's been structured has been with a male lens, and we need different lenses and different perspectives, and that will make things change. So what can people do? What can women do? What can male allies do? We need those male allies. I don't know how many of your listeners are male, but we need them. Is engagement in the issue of restructuring society so that we get that plurality of views and experiences and positions. We need the optimism and the understanding that this needs perseverance. Those of you who are interested in political engagement, please engage with the Centenary Action, which is a coalition. It involves about 10 million people indirectly, because we've got Mumsnet and the WIs and the many, many organisations. But individuals, please kind of look up the Centenary Action and see if you can engage, amplify. Let's get our parliament. I said we were 46 in the world in terms of the gender representation, i.e. we've got 45 countries doing better than us. Let's make sure that by 2028, we are way up there, that we have 50%. We can do it because we are focused. We think by the next election, we think after this election, it might go up to about 40% of women, possibly. If we do, then it's only another 10% to get to 40%, from 40 to 50%. We are addressing the barriers. We're understanding them. We're understanding particular vulnerabilities. So, for example, disabled people in Parliament face specific problems. We need to do things about that, not ignore that. So understand intersectionality. And with enough push and demand, I think we can get there.
Would you say 2028, what would be your ideal? Top 10%?
Let's go for it. Yes.
I think I just went, I just shot for the moon. But you know what? You know, this is the thing. Yeah, I wanted to ask about legacy. Your daughter, Laura, is continuing the family legacy with her work at the Ministry of Justice. I'm just wondering what, if you could, and we're coming to the end of this podcast, what if you could share one piece of advice to young feminists of today? I'm going to even say myself here. Yeah, actually, forget young women today. What we've just talked there, didn't we, about what what we can do just generally in life, but I'm more thinking maybe in our souls. And what piece of advice would you give to our souls?
Yeah, I'm really interesting. And I love the idea of our souls. So my daughter, it's actually Laura is the way we pronounce it.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry.
It's because it links to my Ethiopian background and it means let me speak in Amharic. So to have a daughter that wants to speak has been really important. And I also have a son, Alex, and he doesn't come through that often because he's been a bit quieter in the background. But interestingly, I'm hoping that he will take on the mantle a little bit of as a man speaking about feminism as a male ally. Laura has been quite quiet in terms of engaging in on her own on feminist issues, I think because she feels that she wants to grow and become herself and take on the issues that are important to her. But as you said, she works at the Ministry of Justice. I think coming back to an echo of what you said earlier, what we talked about in terms of looking after ourselves and the issue of being time poor as women and even as young women, I think recognizing that, I think looking after ourselves, women often put others in front of themselves. I think managing that and yet also caring and ensuring that the next generation has fewer battles to fight. I feel like that is something that we do inherently pass on the baton to the next generation. So I think important that we keep doing things, not expecting simplistic, small, solutions to it all, but feeling that we are part of a movement, part of the power, the collective power, and that small acts and individuals matter. And do it with others, don't do it alone. I think that's really important. The sisterhood matters.
I just want to echo that. The sisterhood matters. If we want to talk to our souls today, we have a sisterhood. For everyone out there who's never even thought about that, I am your sister, Helen is your sister, we are sisters. And that, in its very nature, we don't talk about. And having each other's back and understanding with empathy every day what we are all dealing with, and small acts of kindness to self and others. I mean, I just think that the more we can spread that word, the more that their soul can be sort of a bit more equipped to deal with some of those absolutely right points, which are the things that we can do. I know you've got busy work. We need you out there, Helen, right? So I'm not going to take too much longer, but I do have to say, you're going to be one of those podcasts I listen to again and again and again, because I feel fired up. I know everyone's feeling fired up. At the end of this podcast, I do use the analogy for everyone on this podcast, within their business, within their journey, within their vision or their passion, what they're leading. What would you say has been one of your biggest lows during this roller coaster ride?
There's one that is two-pronged because it happened more or less at the same time. My divorce and endometrial cancer, they happened quite close together, and it was thought to be stage 4 endometrial cancer, which is really, really bad endometrial cancer. So it meant a hysterectomy, chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And that soon after divorce, those together were the low light without any doubt.
I can't imagine that. And I can understand why that's your low. Are you happy today, Helen?
Yes, I am. I am very much so. Yeah.
And healthy?
Getting healthy.
Thank goodness. As you said, we need you intact and strong and happy to have our backs. And conversely, can I ask you, Helen, what would you say on that roller coaster? You're wearing green and purple today. It's not gone unmissed. What would you say on your feminist roller coaster? What would be one of your greatest highs?
I was thinking about this a lot because they're quiet moments, they're individual moments, they're small group moments, but probably being at the opening of the Olympic ceremony in London and being part of the Olympic suffragettes, as we then became called, being part of that moment of positivity in London. And there was just so many people and we were dressed up as suffragettes. I was with Lara. We formed this group, the small group, and then we were linked up with all the other volunteers, that sense of volunteerism, that sense of purpose and fun. It was an amazing moment and it still resonates. The music, the showcasing of the best of what we could be as a country.
How proud were we that day?
Yeah.
I mean, that was, isn't it? That would be the country country's, I think, high moment on my roller coaster. It was, and what a moment, what a thing to share with your daughter as well. I mean, gosh, what a memory. Helen, I know you know this, but this is the part of the podcast where I'm going to hand over to you. I ask you if you would do us the honour of reading a letter to your younger self. I don't know what age you've picked or what type of young Helen you're thinking of when you read it, read this letter, but thank you for sharing a part of your soul with us today.
Real pleasure. Here we go. Dear me. Well, Helen, this is a really odd thing to do. Me, an older you, writing to you, a younger me. Once I got my head around the request that I write a letter to my younger self, the first thing that occurred to me is that this exercise of thinking across time links to something that I, that you, will get used to doing because of your Pankhurst identity. Thinking about the past, about our ancestors and their impact on women and girls in the present and the future, it becomes very much part of the life, part of who you are, as you reflect on how far women's lives has or hasn't changed and think about the personal in that, in your own life. And you will be asked about them and how much of them you carry with you. So maybe this letter is part of that exercise. Therefore, a key theme of my letter to you is the importance of recognising and valuing our experiences as girls and women, our voice, our agency, our choices. Whatever you do, you and I are enveloped in that family story and the link that it creates to so many other women and girls in the past, our presence and our futures. What else? You won't be surprised to hear that your own life, like those of probably everybody else, will not be a smooth linear trajectory, but one with many curves and meanderings, with troughs and peaks, with good times, indifferent times, and pretty rotten ones. Focusing on the crisis points, because I guess that's what you'll be most worried about, what can I say to help you get through these? There is the obvious. Hang in there, they too will pass. But more than that, maybe I can alert you to what did help. Friendships, family, walking and nature, keeping fit. Yes, and that's an important one. Don't wait until you're nearly 60 to get to discover yoga. And healthy eating, with a good dollop of treats. You taught me that. In some ways, it gets easier. We get older as we get older. But there are also aspects that are harder. I mentioned crisis points earlier, but for the most part, I wouldn't wish even those moments away. It doesn't feel right to say too much about the difficulties you face, but don't be in a rush. You'll be okay, and it's a great journey. And as for the highlights, I had planned not to tell you about these as well, but I'm sorry, I can't be quiet on them, particularly the amazing and quirky children that you will have and that in your eyes will be the best of you. And the friendships you make, they are gold dust. You and I develop great networks of friends and colleagues, or frolleagues, as one of them would say, not surprisingly, perhaps mainly women, that share our sense of purpose and fun. I need to close because there's so much to be done. I am speaking to you just before an election. So I want to come back to what I started the letter with. You and I are connected to the icons that were our female ancestors, and through them to feminism that is in our bones. It is our superpower. Or rather, it is the glitter that shines through our lives and that we try and sprinkle all around and as widely as possible. With lots of love to you at every point of our journey, Helen.
You are someone we so admire, Helen. And for everyone listening in this podcast, you've made a profound effect. You've profoundly moved them, and you will profoundly have moved them to action, I think, honestly. And your unwavering commitment to women's rights, your passion, your determination, your dedication, and it, around our voices when we don't have them, is just something that is to be behold. And I think the spirit of suffragettes and this fight that you're doing for us, it's we've got you, we applaud you, and we're behind you. And I just have to thank you. It's one of the most beautiful moments to interview you on my podcast. I can't quite believe it. Aww. I feel quite emotional, but thank you so much, Helen, for your time today.
Thanks very much. And it's very much shoulder to shoulder, all of us, and appreciate everything that you're doing as well, Holly.
thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.